And happy birthday today to Beulah Bloom of Rockwell and to Jim Hartman of West Des Moines. Happy birthday, Beulah and Jim, to both of you. You're joined on your birthday by some famous people. Catherine Ross turns 84 today. Tom Selleck turns 79. And Oprah Winfrey turns 70 years old today. Well, if you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, on your television on Iowa PBS, and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now it's time for obituaries, and here's Nicole with the one obituary that we have today.
Yes, we are going to remember Richard Werzer of Des Moines. Richard Werzer was from Coon Rapids and passed away in Des Moines on Thursday, January 25th, peacefully, surrounded by his family. He survived by his daughter Visola, as well as his siblings with their spouses, Gary and Pat, Deborah and Tom, Joe and Ennis, Janet and Jean, and Dean, Lisa and Mark, Mary and Mark, and Jane and Dave. He is preceded in death by his parents, Elizabeth and Leon Werzer, and also his brother Leon, and also his widow Renee. He graduated from Iowa State University and was an avid Cyclone fan. He worked in the Department of Inspections and Appeals for the state of Iowa for 24 years, and he loved riding in Ragbri with the Tall Dogs Bicycle Club, in addition to other area rides. He also enjoyed reading for IRIS, the Iowa Reading and IRIS, the Iowa Reading and Information Service, as well as umpiring softball, baseball, and various other sports. He will be missed. Memorial should be sent to St. Jude's. Online condolences are welcome at the Illis Funeral Home site. Thank you to the palliative and intensive care teams at Mercy One Medical Center for the excellent care and making both Richard and his family comfortable in his final days. His visitation will be 2 to 4 in the afternoon on Thursday, February 1st at the Illis Westover Chapel. The celebration of life service will be followed at 4 p.m. There is one death notice here for Cindy Arbogast of Ankeny, age of 69. Cindy passed away on January 28th, and there's no service time listed here just yet. And if you don't mind, I will finish that Forever Chemical story, and then Twyla will take over. All right, so we were at the level, will high levels of PFAS make me sick? Not necessarily and not immediately. So exactly how much PFOA or PFOS it takes to harm somebody is still not known. PFAS are bioaccumulative, which means that they build up in living tissue over time before they start to affect your bodily systems. And your community may not have as high of a concentration as others. When the EPA released its new advisories, it said that they were designed to protect pregnant women, young children, and the elderly over a lifetime of constant exposure. The CDC recommends that your healthcare provider consider your exposure history and any results from local water testing before suggesting PFAS testing on you. The CDC says that PFAS blood testing results do not provide information for treatment or predict future health problems. Courtney Carrion, an exposure scientist and environmental epidemiologist at Michigan State University, says, "When you look at the laundry list of health effects that have been linked to PFAS, it doesn't mean that you're going to get that. Everyone's risk factors are different, but you can reduce your risk by reducing your exposure and also getting your drinking water tested." So where does the EPA find pollutants? Of about 3,200 systems included so far, 854 measured at least one PFAS compound above the EPA's reporting levels. That is according to a USA Today analysis of the federal environmental data. That is almost a 27%, or that is almost 27%, an increase from August's update of that data. Many municipal water agencies already test for PFAS. Last year, the company 3M agreed to a $10.3 billion lawsuit settlement with a global chemical company and also about 300 communities that were seeking funds to purify their water from the PFAS pollution. Other cities are now testing their water to see if they qualify. Firefighters and other first responders who believe the chemicals negatively impact their health may have also filed lawsuits.
A study finds that 26,000 Texas pregnancies are from rapes. This article is from the Austin American Statesman, a part of the USA Today network. More than 26,000 Texans are estimated to have become pregnant as a result of a rape since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade in June of 2022, the highest number among the 14 states that enacted total abortion bans after the high court ended the federal right to terminate a pregnancy, according to a peer-reviewed study published in the Journal of American Medical Association. The study, published Wednesday, estimates that in the 14 states, 5,586 of the rape-related pregnancies, or 9%, occurred in states with rape exceptions to their bans, and 58,979, or 91%, occurred in states with no exceptions. Texas, which allows abortions only when the life of the mother is at risk, had the most pregnancies resulting from rapes, 26,313, or 45% of the 14 states' combined total. Fewer than 10 abortions per month are reported in each of the states analyzed, the study said. In Texas, an average of 9 abortions per month occurred between July of 2022 and June of 2023, according to the Society for Family Planning. In 2021, the year when the state banned abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, more than 50,000 pregnancies were terminated in Texas. In 2020, nearly 54,000 abortions occurred, according to data from the Texas Health and Human Services Department. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris have made abortion rights, and Texas ban in particular, a focus of their reelection campaign, featuring plaintiffs of a major Texas abortion lawsuit over medical exceptions in campaign ads. The White House has also invited Kate Cox, a Dallas woman whose request to terminate a pregnancy with a fatal fetal diagnosis was rejected by the Texas Supreme Court in December, to attend Biden's State of the Union address in March. It is unconscionable that this is happening in America. The overturning of Roe v. Wade has already led to 21 dangerous abortion bans in effect in state across the country, many of which have no exceptions for race or incest, White House spokesperson Kelly Scully told the American Statesman. That's the Austin newspaper that this article is from. To form the basis of the study, researchers used confidential survey data on sexual assault from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention and crime data from the FBI and Justice Department to estimate rape numbers. Researchers then applied state-level data on that percentage of completed rapes that resulted in pregnancies. They projected that 519,981 completed rapes and 64,565 resulting pregnancies occurred during the 4 to 18 months the abortion bans have been in effect in all 14 states. Five of the states studied have exceptions for rape, but require the assaults to be reported to law enforcement. Women are most likely to experience sexual assault at the hands of intimate partners or acquaintances. Only about 1 in 5 rapes are committed by strangers, according to Justice Department statistics. Dr. Carrie White, the report's co-author and director of the Austin-based Resound Research for Reproductive Health, said that under those circumstances, seeking abortion care is more complicated for many survivors.
And right next to it, Biden Scholz set to meet in Washington next week. President Joe Biden will host German Chancellor Olaf Scholz at the White House on February 9th as the West struggles to provide new aid for Ukraine in the war against Russia. The White House said in a statement on Saturday, the two leaders will affirm their resolute to support for Ukraine's defense of its land and its people against Russia's war of aggression. The United States is out of money for Ukraine, unable to send ammunition and missiles that the government in Kyiv needs to fend off Russia. The Biden administration already has sent Ukraine $111 billion in weapons, equipment, humanitarian assistance, and other aid since Russian President Vladimir Putin launched his invasion in February of 2022. Biden's package of $110 billion in new aid for Ukraine, Israel, and other national security needs has stalled because of disagreements between Congress and the White House over other policy priorities. That includes additional security for the U.S.-Mexico border. The total includes about $61 billion in assistance for Ukraine. The European Union last month met and paid the final installment of a multi-billion euro support package to Ukraine to help keep its economy afloat. The EU's executive branch, the European Commission, has proposed to provide Ukraine with $55 billion, and at a summit before the last payout, 26 of the 27 nation bloc's leaders endorsed that plan, but Hungary imposed a veto. EU leaders are expected to meet again on Thursday to attempt a deal on the financial package, but the veto power by Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, who is considered to be Putin's closest ally in the EU, does remain a factor. The Israel-Hamas war will also be a focus of the White House meeting between Biden and Scholz. The leaders will talk about the efforts to prevent regional escalation in the Middle East, their steadfast support for Israel's right to self-defense, and the imperative of increasing life-saving assistance and protection of civilians from harm in Gaza. This is according to a statement from White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Moving now to the USA Today recap of Nation and World reports, GOP governors back Abbott on the border. Almost every Republican governor has signed on to a statement backing Texas Governor Greg Abbott in his bitter fight against the federal government over border control. The statement, released January 25 on the Republican Governors Association website, criticized the Biden administration and said Texas has the constitutional right to defend itself. Last week, Texas officials and the Department of Homeland Security sparred over barbed wire along the Rio Grande. We stand in solidarity with our fellow Governor Greg Abbott and the state of Texas in utilizing every tool and strategy, including razor wire fences, to secure the border, says the letter signed by 25 Republican governors. Because the Biden administration has abdicated its constitutional compact duties to the states, Texas has every legal justification to protect the sovereignty of our states and our nation, the statement said. The White House addressed the governor's statement at a press briefing on Friday. I would say to them that if they truly want to help with the issue of the border with the immigration system, that they need to talk to the congressional members, the senators in their state, said White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. They need to ask them to make sure that they have the resources they need within their respective states to take action, actually to deal with a broken system, she said. Governors from the following states signed the statement supporting Abbott, and these are listed alphabetically: Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Indiana, Iowa, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, Virginia, West Virginia, and Wyoming. Vermont Governor Phil Scott is the only Republican governor who did not sign on to the statement in support of Abbott. As part of Operation Lone Star, Abbott's $11 billion border security initiative, Texas implemented several measures to block migrants from entering the state, including setting up the razor wire, placing large water buoys in the Rio Grande, and building segments of a state border wall. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled federal agents can remove the razor wire after the federal government earlier this month sought an emergency ruling allowing it to do so to reach migrants or officers in distress and to patrol the southern border. But the ruling did not seem to deter Abbott, who posted on social media saying, "This is not over." That's a quote from his post. The Texas Military Department also posted photos Tuesday of soldiers installing more wire in Eagle Pass, where the state bars federal agents from accessing Shelby Park. Abbott and his supporters point to two provisions in the U.S. Constitution. The first is Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, which says the U.S. will defend states against invasion. And the second is Article 1, Section 12, Clause 3, which bans states from engaging in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. That's an end of the quote of the constitutional passages that Abbott is quoting. Abbott and the faction of governors argue that the Biden administration has failed to uphold duties in the former, allowing Texas to invade federal guidance in the name of the latter. Instead of upholding the rule of law and securing the border, the Biden administration has attacked and sued Texas for stepping up to protect American citizens from historic levels of illegal immigrants, deadly drugs like fentanyl, and terrorists entering our country, Republican governors said in their statement. Though the letter expressed support of this argument, there were few details about support beyond solidarity. Some signatories posted on X, the formerly known as Twitter, in support of Abbott as well, recalling previously sending National Guard troops from their state to help the border control, though none committed additional resources in light of recent battles. In the Friday press briefing, Jean-Pierre called Abbott's defiance shameful. She went on to say, "It is shameful that we continue to see these political stunts and we continue to see these political games. It's not safe, it does not help solve the problem, and it does not help solve the issue."
New Hampshire may have shown Trump's vulnerability. Biden could find opening among independents, from Joey Garrison and Michael Collins of USA Today. Donald Trump's double-digit victory in last week's New Hampshire Republican primary strengthened his grip on the party's nomination, but yet exposed his greatest weakness as a general election candidate, reinforcing President Joe Biden's roadmap to beat him in the fall. Trump's poor showing with New Hampshire's independent voters, combined with some Republicans who said they won't back the former president if he's the Republican nominee, underscored the risk that Trump poses for the GOP as their nominee. Former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley won 58% of New Hampshire's 4% of primary electorate, compared with Trump's 39%, according to exit polls. Haley topped Trump's 56%, 42% among voters with college degrees. Perhaps most alarming for the former president is about 90% of Haley's voters in New Hampshire, a battleground in the general election, said that they would be dissatisfied if Trump were the nominee. And 83% of Haley voters said that Trump, who's facing multiple criminal indictments, would be unfit for office if convicted. Simon Rosenberg, a longtime Democratic strategist, says the warning signs are there. This idea that somehow Trump is strong and is doing better than he did in 2016 and 2020, it's a joke. What we're seeing is the non-MAGA wing of the Republican Party is very reticent about joining forces with MAGA in 2024. Independent and college-educated voters, particularly in fast-growing suburbs, have become the key swing vote in recent presidential elections. Biden's strong showing with this group in Georgia, Michigan, and other battleground states powered his victory against Trump in 2020. Democratic strategist and author Melissa DeRosa says, "The question is, where does that critical middle swing? Where does it go? And I think that the Republican Party should be very fearful coming out of New Hampshire that Biden is going to have the edge with independents." Even as Haley vowed to fight on, Biden has pivoted fully to a rematch against Trump after the outcome in New Hampshire, declaring in a statement that it is now clear that Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee. It's a contest the campaign already has started bracing for. Biden, who has long railed on extreme MAGA Republicans, has worked to make restoring abortion rights a top theme of his candidacy and has cast Trump as a threat to democracy, leaning into messages that energize not only Democrats but independent voters. Abortion, DeRosa says, is a case where a clear majority of voters side with Democrats and where you can point to Donald Trump and what he said as president is taking rights away or undermining rights on abortion access. Last week, the Biden campaign launched a full-scale attack on Trump on abortion rights, reminding voters that it was Trump's three Supreme Court appointments that produced the conservative majority that overturned the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which provided a constitutional right to an abortion. Biden says on Tuesday at a rally in Manassas, Virginia, that's a suburb of Washington, Donald Trump is betting we won't vote on this issue. He is betting that we won't hold him responsible either. Biden kicked off the new year with a dramatic speech in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, arguing democracy is on the ballot in 2024 and also accusing MAGA voices of abandoning the truth about the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Biden called on Democrats, independents, mainstream Republicans to make a choice. He says, "We all know who Donald Trump is. The question is, who are we?" Despite the warning signs for Trump in New Hampshire, Biden trails Trump in most head-to-head polls, losing among independents and underperforming with key factions of the Democratic coalition, Black, Hispanic, and young voters. Biden, who turned to 81 years old in November, faces his own shortcomings in a Trump rematch. Concerns from voters about his age, lagging enthusiasm among the Democratic base, surging migration at the southern border, and an enduring struggle to get credit for his legislative accomplishments. The Biden campaign has downplayed the polling struggles, arguing that as the election gets closer, a contrast between Trump's campaign of revenge and retribution versus Biden running to move the country forward will crystallize for voters. Hardened concerns about the economy amid stubborn inflation remain another problem for Biden. Polling has regularly found a majority of voters trust Trump more than Biden to handle the economy. But improving consumer coincidence suggests that Biden could finally begin to capitalize politically on positive economic metrics such as low employment, a booming stock market, and a growing gross domestic product. Biden says on Thursday in Superior, Wisconsin, touting his historic infrastructure law, he says things are finally beginning to sink in. We knew that it was going to take time for it to begin to take hold, but it's really taken hold now and turning the economy around. They also argued the economy could become a weakness for Trump. Donald Trump, he says, the thing you really want for the economy is to thrive and grow is stability and predictability. Two things that Donald Trump is not, she says. Donald Trump is a flamethrower. William Howell, a political scientist from the University of Chicago, says Biden's early appointment of Trump as the Republican nominee provides an opportunity for him to create a coherent, forceful story that has been missing amid the constant drama surrounding Trump and his Republican primary. Howell says what Biden needs to do is start to shape the narrative about his first term in office and the stakes involved in this upcoming election. He's been at the fringes of political coverage, and he can't be. He is the president, and he is running for re-election, and that needs to change. Democratic strategist Josh Sherwin says that the election will be desired not only by who can do a better job of turning out their base, but also who can win over swing voters who aren't in love with either candidate.
And we're going to share with you, as we wrap up the front page section of the Register, this opinion statement from the Register's editorial board, which is included as part of the front page section today. It's entitled, New Anti-Trans Bill Makes It Okay to Hate. And the editorial board says, stop this, Iowa. If the Iowa legislature successfully revises Iowa law to remove civil rights protections for transgendered people and instead label them disabled, they will not change who those transgendered Iowans are. They will still identify differently from their gender assigned at birth because that is their innate sense of who they are. Legislators' votes and personal attacks will not change that. The government can change plenty of other things, of course, and real dangers are the most significant reason that Iowans are raising alarms about the hearing scheduled for noon Wednesday at the Capitol on House File 2082. Other laws passed in recent years to restrict trans Iowans' participation in sports, to receive potentially life-saving medical care, and to see their lives reflected in school materials have been plenty misguided and harmful. But this bill has a larger scope, and it lacks the fig leaf of concern for children's well-being that advocates relentlessly claimed motivated their previous laws. Iowa civil rights law bars discrimination based on protected characteristics in employment, housing, schooling, lending, and other areas. Right now, it's illegal to deny a loan or a lease to someone because that person is trans. House File 2082 would change that. It would make it okay to hate. Continuing now with this opinion piece from the Des Moines Register's editorial board, sexual orientation and gender identity were added as protective classes in a bipartisan bill in 2007. The protections for gay and lesbian Iowans made the most headlines then. The law even included a proviso that it would not be construed as condoning same-sex marriage. Proposals to undo that law have been introduced often since then. It takes only one lawmaker to put out any idea, and Representative Jeff Shipley of Fairfield, the sponsor of House File 2082, annually produces bills to do such things as removing vaccination requirements and legalizing hallucinogenic drugs. Many radical proposals every year go largely ignored by both the public and by legislative leaders. But assigning a three-person subcommittee and allowing its chair to to schedule a hearing can be the first sign that leaders, in this case House Judiciary Committee Chairman Stephen Holt, a Denison Republican, might allow an idea to be seriously considered. This is the first time that's happened with a bill to remove gender identity from the civil rights law. Holt did not allow a hearing on a similar bill in 2020. He told the Register that he still has concerns, but wanted to have the conversation. He said that transgender Iowans would retain other protections in federal law and expressed interest in disability rights protections for them, since the Iowa bill would classify any condition related to a gender identity disorder as a disability. A lobbyist for the LGBTQ advocacy group One Iowa said that would not be helpful to anybody. No group of Iowans should be relegated to second-class status, One Iowa Action Executive Director Courtney Reyes said in a prepared statement. The subcommittee members are Republicans Charlie Thomas, a Northern Iowa attorney, and John Wills, the third-ranking Republican in the House, and Democrat Sammy Sheets of Cedar Rapids. Members of the public can speak at the meeting, but only in person in room 102 on the first floor of the State House. Anybody can watch online. The likely scenario is this. Lobbyists, whose clients favor enshrining conservative Christian viewpoints in the law, will praise Shipley for his courage and claim they're taking a stand for truth against vast swaths of medical experts. Some of those medical experts will testify about the evidence supporting their views. Shipley will likely deliver a meandering defense of the bill. Many Iowans will share their stories and fears about the likely consequences of the bill. It's not unheard of for the majority party representatives at a subcommittee to decide it's not time to advance an idea. But usually on these topics, the two Republicans vote to advance the bill, quote, to continue the conversation, end quote, while the Democrat votes no. Iowans who wish to resist this deliberate infliction of harm can reach out to Thompson, Wills, and Sheets, and also to Holt, who controls whether his committee eventually takes up the bill, and their own lawmaker. More details are below. And again, continuing with this opinion piece from the Register's editorial board. Bills like this are exactly why trans Iowans and their families have fled the state. My high school classmates, Nia and Kate Charmante, are one such family. They are the subjects of a Hulu documentary, and they explicitly say they left Indianola for the East Coast because of the legislature's action. Other trans Iowans might not have the means to leave. They could face a future of state-sanctioned discrimination and bullying. Beyond the moral argument, there's also a practical one. Business groups have long said that protections like these are important to their efforts to hire and retain a diverse workforce. Many Iowans rightfully take pride in this state's judicial history of outlawing school segregation and legalizing same-sex marriage long before most other states. The prospect of stripping away civil rights protections from a group of Iowans is a shameful portrayal of that legacy. Iowans need to tell their legislators to stop House File 2082. And that concludes this opinion from the Register's editorial board. Do you have a couple of short state shorts you want to wrap us up with, Nicole?
I always love 50 states, so we'll do a couple of those or a few of those until our time runs out. We'll start with the highlight today. It is out of Florida in Tampa. Revelers clad in pirate finery packed Tampa's waterfront Saturday as a flotilla of boats arrived for the city's annual Gasparilla Pirate Fest. It's led by Yay Mystic Curie of Gasparilla. The invading pirates docked to make a final demand for the key to the city. Once ashore, the festivities celebrating their annual invasion included an afternoon parade through downtown and live music. A fixture nearly every year since 1904, the Gasparilla Pirate Fest is named for the mythical pirate Jose Gaspar. That's not much evidence that he actually existed, but according to the legend, he plundered ships and also captured hostages in the Gulf of Mexico from the 1780s until around 1821. And we only had time for one, actually, so that's it for the 50 states today.
Okay, thanks, Nicole. It's also it for this shift. So for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Nicole Tam and me, Twyla Glenn. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. We'll continue now with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Carol with our first opinion piece.
Thank you, Jeff. And hello, everyone. Democracy isn't the only thing on the ballot. It says, after the results of Tuesday's New Hampshire primary, it now seems all but inevitable that Donald Trump will be the Republican Party nominee for president once again and face a rematch with President Joe Biden in November. What does that mean for our nation and the world? Members of the USA Today opinion team share their thoughts. And there are two articles here, or maybe, oh, I guess there are four, actually. I'll read the, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I guess three of these here, Jeff. Biden versus Trump rematch is a stress for democracy. And this is by Tim Swarens. As much as I want Nikki Haley to somehow heave that last-second Hail Mary that floats into the heart-shaped hands of Travis Kelce, standing blissfully alone in the end zone, it's not going to happen. It's still technically the first quarter of the long Republican primary season, but this game is over. Taylor Swift has left the building. I had breakfast with a much younger friend in the cold, gray aftermath of Trump's march through New Hampshire. My friend said he's worried, for the first time in his life, that our nation cannot handle whatever results Election Day gives us in November. And it's not an irrational fear. A new poll conducted by Canada's Angus Reid Institute found that only 32% of Americans say they will fully accept the results of the 2024 presidential election, regardless of whether Biden or Trump wins. And strong majorities of both Biden and Trump supporters say American democracy will be much weaker if the opposing candidate wins the presidency. So the concerns about our democracy are broad and deep. And don't overlook this last point, bipartisan. But what can we do about it now that the electoral rematch so many of us did not want is upon us? As an old school conservative, I say that the greatest platform for social and political changes starts with the individual. Want to save American democracy? Start by truly valuing the diversity of this nation and summoning the self-discipline to respect the neighbor who does not think the same as you. Turn off the talking heads, shut down the social media, and find the courage to engage with someone whose life experiences and values don't reflect your own. You don't have to agree with them. It's America, after all, but you can learn to respect the other. That's not easy, of course. And it may be naive to believe enough of us will walk that path to make a difference. Yet, your doctor is not wrong when she says diet and exercise are the best vehicles for safeguarding your health, but all you really want are ice cream and the couch. Our nation faces a stress test this year. I'm confident we'll pass if we come together. Again, that was by Tim Swarens. And here's Jeff.
More than 50 nations hold the Super Bowl of elections. This piece by Thuan Lee Elston. The U.S. presidential election is not the only critical vote this year. The Associated Press says more than 50 countries are holding elections. The Atlantic Council counts nearly 80 in this Super Bowl of voting. Either way, these nations are home to over 4 billion people, or half of humanity. From Mexico to Russia, South Africa to Indonesia, what free voters in authoritarian regimes do in the 2024 elections will affect everything from wars to economics, climate change, and human rights. Among the first to hold an election this month was Taiwan, where voters elected a president opposed by China, because he rejects the communist neighbor's claims over his democratic island nation. Happy early Lunar New Year. What a way to welcome the Year of the Dragon, which begins February 10th. This circles back to Trump, whose presidential inauguration in 2017 was right before the lunar year of the cock. That season's depictions of Rooster Trump, though, included one that reminded me of another cocky character, Humpty Dumpty. Trump proved me right throughout his presidency by twisting words and events into lies. It's straight out of Through the Looking Glass by Lewis Carroll. Quote, "When I use a word," Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone, "it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." "The question is," said Alice, "whether you can make words mean so many different things." "The question is," said Humpty Dumpty, "which is to be master, that's all." We know what eventually happened to that egg, but we don't know who will master 2024. As we face months of Trump politically campaigning through his multitudes of criminal trial dates before we find out who our next president is, remember we're not alone in this critical election year. Before it ends, billions of other voters worldwide are holding their breath, too. Carol?
And our next opinion comes from Chris Brennan, and it's entitled, "Biden Desperately Needs the Trump Fever Not to Break." For nearly a decade, Americans have been told to watch for the fever that drives Trump to break. It was never going to happen. The Trump fever burns as long as he lives. If Trump wins back the White House, it will be a pyre for the norms of the presidency that he didn't scorch in his one term. If he loses again, it will be a conflagration of agitating rhetoric about how everything was rigged and witch hunt and totally unfair and blah, blah, blah. You can expect Biden to push this message from now until November. And here's the part the president will leave out. He desperately needs the heat of Trump's fever. It's Biden's only hope for a second term. Biden needs to revise his 2020 role as firefighter. The Republican Party is incapable of extinguishing Trump. So many of the party's biggest names denounced him after the insurrection on January 6, 2021, laying the blame at Trump's feet. Now they're back in line, dutifully swearing allegiance to the man, lest they suffer the burn. Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis or Chris Christie could have confounded Biden for months, offering a clear option for something new. That's why Biden celebrated Trump's New Hampshire win. He needs the same old Trump around, easy to inflame, always smoldering with rage that could consume everything around him. Trump has held every kind of position in the Republican Party since 2015, an arc from early election campaign sideshow to provocateur to frontrunner to preening victor to the sorest of losers to criminal defendant and, again, frontrunner. And he's always been the same guy, running the same fever. And, Jeff, back to you.
There is much more than democracy on the ballot. This piece by Ingrid Jacques. Biden gave his first campaign speech of the year near Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, ahead of the third anniversary of the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. He pounded his favorite theme, whether democracy is still America's sacred cause is the most urgent question of our time, and it's what the 2024 election is all about. Is it? The election is about a whole lot more. After 3 years of the Biden administration, other things are on the ballot too for millions of Americans. The economy is on the ballot. Years of high prices are on the ballot. Illegal immigration and an insecure border are on the ballot. Costly new regulations are on the ballot. Unconstitutional policies and executive orders are on the ballot. Yet Biden and his advisors don't want to talk about their failures. They want to make this election all about Trump, who's an easy target and drives Democrats batty. While I'm still holding out hope that Nikki Haley can start winning in the Republican primaries, it's looking more and more like a Trump-Biden rematch. If that happens, Democrats will double down on how Trump, MAGA, and Republicans in general are somehow on the anti-democracy bandwagon. Just as in 2016, they must be, quote, fascists, racists, or in the basket of deplorables. The fact is, most voters head to the polls because of the issues that affect them most directly. Their quality of life, their jobs, their communities. And no matter how vile you may think Trump is, many people feel like their lives were better during his presidency. Boiling this election down to a democracy may lead to some sexy sound bites and take the heat off Biden, but it oversimplifies a complex situation and threatens to further divide us.
And our final opinion is from Rex Hupke. It's entitled, Time to Quit Bellyaching, Like It or Not, as Biden or Trump. As mystifying as it is for liberals like me, and I'd bet a good number of thoughtful conservatives as well, to imagine anyone in their right mind casting a vote for Donald Trump again, here we are. And as mystifying as it may be for conservatives, thoughtful or otherwise, and a small but noisy swath of liberals, to imagine why Democrats would trot President Biden out, Joe Biden out for re-election. Here we are. Barring unforeseen developments on the GOP side of the fence, and with Trump in the mix, anything is possible. Americans will have a choice in November between Biden and Trump. Both are old. Each side finds the opposing candidate repellent. But guess what? This is it, kids. The time for second-guessing candidate choices is over. It's time to stop bellyaching and get to work. From where I stand, Trump presents a clear and present danger to this country. He's increasingly unhinged. He cares about nobody but himself, and he already fomented one violent insurrection. Putting him back in power would cause untold harm, on top of the untold harm he's already caused by brainwashing a large swath of the population and convincing them the 2020 presidential election was not legitimate. I'm a lot more concerned about that than I am about Biden's age, which happens to be only 3 years more than Trump's. Frankly, the threat Trump poses, his ability to violently divide our nation, is the only thing I care about in this election. Trump needs to be stopped, and the Republican Party needs to be defeated in a way that forces it to move on from MAGA madness and return to some form of sanity. I get why a lot of people are unhappy with our choices, but at this juncture, they are what they are. So buckle up, folks. Much is at stake, and we have work to do. And again, that was from Rex Huppy, and here is Jeff.
Let's turn to the sports section and let you know what's on TV today. men's college basketball at 6 o'clock, Boston U and Holy Cross on CBS Sports, and on ESPN is Duke and Virginia Tech. At 9 o'clock on ESPN, Houston at Texas and Alcorn State at Bethune-Cookman. Women's college basketball at 3 o'clock on CBS is Boston at Holy Cross, and at 7 is on ESPN2, LSU at Mississippi State, and Georgia at Auburn on the SEC Network. College gymnastics can be seen on the Big Ten Network at 6 o'clock. That's women's gymnastics, Illinois at Ohio State. And NBA basketball at 7:30 on NBA TV is Phoenix at Miami. At 10 o'clock is Philadelphia at Portland. Hockey, 6 o'clock on the NHL Network, Nashville at Ottawa. And then there's soccer, men's soccer at 1:45 on FS2. Is the U23 Olympic qualifier and the 24 group stage, Brazil versus Ecuador, and in Group A from Caracas, Venezuela. Also at 5:45, same tournament, the 2024 group stage, Colombia versus Venezuela from Caracas again. And at tennis, at 11 o'clock this, or no, excuse me, 10 o'clock this morning, about, you can turn it on now. Tennis is the Montpelier ATP. That's the early rounds. Going to sports news, Iowa Hawkeyes found a new offensive coordinator. Chad Leistikow writes, the good, the worrisome about Lester as the Hawkeyes' new OC. With 3 months to identify, recruit, interview, and choose a future offensive coordinator to pair with Iowa football's championship-level defense and special teams, Kirk Ferentz has landed on former Western Michigan star quarterback and head coach Tim Lester. Two Register sources with direct knowledge of the hiring confirmed the news. Lester, who will turn 47 on February 8th, succeeds Brian Ferentz, the head coach's son, as the Hawkeyes' offensive coordinator, and will be tasked to revive an offense that was by far the worst in college football last season at 234.6 yards per game. Lester arrives in Iowa City with a lot of question marks. His track record doesn't scream great pick as offensive coordinator. Lester and former Duke offensive coordinator Kevin Johns were the two final candidates for the job, although former Wisconsin head coach Paul Christ was Ferentz's first choice. Christ turned down the job in mid-January, forcing Ferentz to scramble. Ferentz is a fantastic leader, but fast-moving improvisation is not one of his strengths. Well, what do we know about Tim Lester? He was a tremendous college quarterback. At Western Michigan from 1996 to 1999, no, he never played against Iowa, Lester passed for 11,299 yards and 87 touchdowns. He spent last season as a senior analyst for the Green Bay Packers, who reached the divisional round of the NFL playoffs before rising quarterback Jordan Love. Before that, he assembled a six-year mark of 37-32 as Western Michigan's coach before being fired in part because of a successful 2021 offense that went into the tank in 2022, plummeting from 12th to 125th nationally. Leister's only track record as a Power 5 offensive coordinator resulted in offenses that finished 116th and 119th nationally at Syracuse in 2014 and 15. He took over the offensive coordinator role 5 games into the 2014 season at Syracuse and went 1-6 down the stretch, putting his overall record as a Power 5 offensive coordinator at 5-14. In 2016, he became the quarterback's coach at Purdue, overseeing a 25-touchdown, 21-interception season from starter David Blow before earning the Western Michigan head coaching gig after P.J. Fleck departed from Minnesota. The case for Lester? Well, let's get into some positive. The Syracuse circumstances were extremely challenging. The 2014 Orange had injuries at quarterback and a poor offensive line that failed to learn more than one snap count. The 2015 season of 4-8 wound up being a lame duck situation as defensive-minded head coach Scott Schaefer was fired, leaving Lester without a job. Once Lester's offense became established at Western Michigan, there was a lot of efficiency to like. Lester also showed an ability to adjust and play to strengths. The case against Lester? Well, even though it's possible to hunt and find some glowing numbers on the stat sheet, the Mid-American Conference is hardly known for great defenses. MAC games frequently become shootouts. While we can point to a nice 2021 statistical profile, 6 of the 8 MAC defenses Lester faced that year ranked 92nd, 94th, 108th, 116th, 122, and 124 out of 130 FBS teams. Again, the only good MAC defense Western Michigan faced that year, which was Toledo, the Broncos were defeated 34-15. Ferentz may never fully explain why he chose Lester to conclude this painfully slow three-month process to identify his son's successor. It's fair to wonder whether Ferentz dragged his feet for too long. He professed in December that he was solely focused on his players and winning the Cheez-It Citrus Bowl. But the Hawkeyes suffered a listless 35-0 loss in Brian Ferentz's last game as OC. In hindsight, that was a highly unproductive December for the future of the Iowa offense. Gradually, we'll learn more answers about whether Lester was the right guy for Hawkeye football. For now, we're left with a lot of lingering questions.
And it's time now for Dear Abby. And the title is, Man Chooses to Feed Vices Rather Than Tackle Debts. Dear Abby, my very dear friend has discovered that her live-in boyfriend of 2 years has been hiding $55,000 in credit card debt. This man contributes very little to the household expenses. She owns the home, and he barely helps to maintain it. Instead, he spends his money on alcohol and vaping products. He refuses to share any details about his debt and does not like being asked about it. She's asked him to drink less and stop vaping entirely, but nothing has changed. What advice should I share with her? I don't want to hurt her feelings, but I want to give fair and honest advice. Signed, A Friend Who Cares in Maine. Abby says, Dear friend, if you want to give your friend fair and honest advice, wait to be asked for it. Do not offer it unsolicited because it will be ignored. If, however, she should ask, feel free to let her have it with both barrels. Her boyfriend is a substance-abusing freeloader who is unwilling to change, and she deserves better. Dear Abby, my best friend, Juliet, recently lost her months-old baby under tragic circumstances. After several months, she is now pregnant again. Abby, I am worried. She's in her 30s and wants to live with her mother for an indefinite period after the baby is born. Juliet is still with her husband. I don't think this is healthy. It will not only take away from the couple's independence, but also reduce Juliet's confidence in being a new mother. We are so close that we call each other soulmates. Should I say something or let her do what she thinks is right? Signed, Standing By in Tennessee. Abby says, Dear Standing By, be concerned as concerned as you are about Juliet. Let her do what she thinks is right. Having lost her baby under tragic circumstances, she needs all the emotional support she can get. If her husband is fine with that arrangement, resist the urge to interfere. And a third, Dear Abby, at Christmas, I worked all day, cooking a lovely turkey dinner with all the side dishes and champagne. I told my mature adult boyfriend that dinner would be ready at 5 p.m. At 5 p.m., I put the hot food on the table and called my boyfriend to come in. Instead of coming to the table, Mr. Mannerless made an unnecessary phone call to a woman friend and talked for nearly an hour. While the dinner got cold, I got hot. When he finally got off the phone, he grabbed a plate of food and left to watch TV. He didn't even eat with me. What should I have done? Signed, Simmering in South Dakota. Dear Simmering, it isn't a matter of what you tend to do about someone as inconsiderate as the unappreciative turkey you have been dating. He may be a mature adult, but his disregard for your feelings is appalling. That's Jeff.
Throw the bum out, huh? Well, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockard. Earlier, you heard from Nicole Tam and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to Iris programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.